دارای یک بازار کاری مشترک و همینطور بازار کارگری مشترک باشه.
When the breakneck speed of the industrial and economic growth of the US and USSR was turning the world into ashes at a time of the crazed speed of Japan's economic growth, Europe had to establish itself as an economic superpower. The euro was a dream the Europeans had to achieve. The euro, which is the common currency of the countries of the European Union, is the blood in the veins of the economies of the bloc, and Frankfurt is its economic beating heart. More than a third of Frankfurt's population is made up of migrants today. And this is how Europe's uniform and cohesive economy survived and made growth on the shoulders of its industrial giants. So much so that today the products of well-known big companies have engraved Europe in the collective memory of everyone around the world. To all of us, Europe is defined by its economy.
Which, with Britain leaving the Union, this leaves two major countries, one economic power and one strategic nuclear power, Germany and France, basically determining most of the policies of the Union and using the Union for their interests. The French interest being a player on the world scale, the German interest being to export as many BMWs to as many countries that you can imagine.
The economy was the most important reason for the formation of the bloc, but it was not the only one. If the madness of the likes of Hitler and Mussolini was supposed to be stopped from casting dark shadows over Europe again, if Europe was able to survive the shattering rivalry between the East and West, if Europe was supposed to be able to battle upcoming military and economic powers in the years to come, it had to unite. Frankfurt, which is home to the European Central Bank, is considered Europe's and Germany's economic hub. It is also where the world's, the European Union's, and Germany's largest industries are usually based or hold their exhibitions.
Different immigration histories and different reasons for being pro-immigration or against immigration. As far as Germany is concerned, Germany is the economic power center of the European Union, which means that the demand for labor is still very high, which also means that Germany needs immigration, because otherwise it can't grow economically. Now, it's always difficult to sell to a public that you need, let's say, 1 million immigrants a year. People do not necessarily like the idea. So then it's useful, it's helpful if you can import refugees, which have a sort of humanitarian reason to be here.
Member countries relinquished an important part of their power and national sovereignty to a huge international union, and in exchange got many things. They became part of a huge and powerful political institution. The political and economic support of the bloc could protect them against numerous crises.
Myself, as a European citizen, maybe, I don't know how these decisions have been taken, so people feel also that power has been moved away from the national countries to a European level, and this feeling of dissatisfaction also adds to the frustration that again leads to a protest vote.
Faced with the problems of today, which are immigration, refugees, terrorism, and there is a threat.
What will the fate of the European Union be? Where will extremist right movements lead it to?
For a hierarchical structure between countries. You speak of an empire if there is a system of countries with a center and a periphery. Countries that are nominally sovereign but de facto have to follow the lead of a central power. Like, for example, in the West for a long time, the American Empire or in the East, in fact, the Russian or Soviet Empire.
But a large portion of the issues of Europe's extremist right is related to the fear of migrants. Migrants who usually come toward Europe from the north of Africa or the Middle East. A united Europe is now a huge and powerful empire again, an effective institution. This is the realization of the same sweet old dream. This time, all roads lead to Brussels. At times, the city of Brussels is considered the symbol of the European Union, especially when it comes to extremist right parties. When they want to showcase the interference of the EU in their country, they point to Brussels as the enemy. For example, they say, "We will stand up to Brussels." The reason is that Brussels is the symbol of the European Union, the headquarters of the European Parliament, and is the city in which most of the European Union's institutions are located. Wherever you see the flag of Belgium and Brussels, you see the flag of the European Union next to it. But this promised land could not remain divine forever. The man-made heaven of the Europeans had many attractions, especially for people who lived in other countries, in deprived lands, in war-stricken countries, regions grappling with droughts, places that looked nothing like Europe. If mankind had been able to create an ideal model for transnational governance after years, why shouldn't it be the right of all people to live under these circumstances? 60-70 years ago, where people are sitting now and taking in the sights of Paris, German Nazi soldiers who had occupied this city were sitting. But as you can see, it very soon changed, and now tourists who are here from across Europe are here because of the European Union and its open border policy. There are also many migrants who come here and put on shows and play music. Maybe these are the causes of the French to ask themselves, why among all the people who are in the city of Paris, many are black, many are wearing hijabs, and many are foreigners? This might make him feel danger because they might not consider these people tourists and think that they are people who are living among the French and are changing France's culture. The process of migrants arriving in Europe sped up, and this itself changed the image of the continent. Europe was not white anymore. The change in the social fabric was inevitable, but it created many crises. This was the most important one, the re-emergence of a nightmare. Almost a year before the chaos surrounding Brexit, two terrorists attacked the office of Charlie Hebdo magazine, a tragedy in response to other bitter events, the harassing of Muslims, the burning of the Quran and others, tragedy alongside other bigger tragedies. A tragedy surrounding the re-emergence of nightmares, the rise of extremist right, or in other words, Europe's fundamentalists. Two main views existed in Europe's foreign policy. One was the Atlantic-leaning view, a view toward the American continent and especially the U.S. The British mostly had this view. The other one was a pan-European view, which said that the Europeans are in actuality of one nationality and race and have to have relations with one another. Our outlook should be focused on Europe. This is the viewpoint which caused the creation of the European Union. And the Atlantic-leaning view caused the exit of Britain from the Union, which is known as Brexit.
Now, if you look at the European Union, these parties are a threat. But for the moment, actually, the Brexit and the election of the Trump have consolidated the feeling that the European Union is essential. If you look at the public opinion, they are not anti-Europe. Actually, in France, the proportion of people who say we need to be united has been going up.
European countries needed a mechanism to guarantee permanent peace, a mechanism that had to simultaneously contain the infiltration of Russian communism and American imperialism, a mechanism to keep the European dream alive, and the bloc was Europe's response to this need to keep these streets happy and safe.
And I think that for doing this we need to restart from the very, very basic level of our all-day life, our all-day relationships, and then to rebuild a different way to do in politics, to take in the public decisions. But before, we have really to reconstruct this sense of relationship.
The general problem of empires is that the periphery needs to be supported by the center. For example, the periphery has to make sure that the center has to make sure that the governments, the semi-autonomous governments of peripheral states, collaborate with the center. For that, you have to give them something. Now, for a while, the center of the empire can extract enough resources from the periphery to pay for its costs and even leave some profit. Now, over time, this becomes more and more difficult. And the larger an empire becomes, the more difficult it becomes. And the question that I'm raising is, for how long will Germany, and it's basically Germany, it's not France, be able to pay for the cohesion of this thing called European Union?
But now, everything is on the edge. Huge economic challenges every once in a while strike one of the member states and affect the economies of the rest of the countries. The unstoppable number of refugees creates a devastating economic and social issue every day. And the right has found an opportunity to emerge again. They believe Europe does not need to remain as one to be European. In a world in which its most powerful politician's trump card is pulling out the US from different international treaties, Europe's right parties are critical of the European Union more than anything else. Instead of sacrificing their short-term and nationality for a common, collective, huge dream. On the one hand, there was a long line of countries which wanted to join the European Union, and on the other, different countries were trying to be inspired by this unique structure and pass similar international treaties. The Arab League, the African League, and many other international organizations and treaties tried to structure themselves in a way to reach the blissful European model. A few years ago, when the European Union was at the peak of its power, Eastern European countries requested that they join the bloc. One of the most important conditions for this to happen is the economic situation in those countries. The Central Bank of Europe studies countries based on the stability of prices, exchange rate stability, GDP, and a number of other important economic indicators, and then allows these countries to become a part of the bloc. Most Eastern European countries became part of the EU, and this in turn later caused the confrontation with Russia, which exists until today. Even a country like Turkey, which has a huge part of it located in Asia, requested to become a member state, and the process took years. The Europeans had different issues with Turkey, from economic topics to human rights issues and others, and in the end, Turkey's accession to the bloc did not happen. But maybe one of the reasons was that Turkey is a Muslim-majority country, and it's neither Christian nor Western. The year 1988, and this important speech by Margaret Thatcher in Bruges, only 13 years after the days that the Iron Lady was taking part in protests in support of a referendum, today what happened to Thatcher is repeating for many other politicians. Many of them, under the shadows of the rise in the extremist right, have come to the conclusion that the bloc is not the best way to achieve the aspirations of their people. They think that a bloc, which was once created to help countries make progress and guarantee security for each other, has now turned into a heavy burden and is decreasing the speed of growth and change. But this is the statue of Joan of Arc, the symbol of France, the leader of the French against the British in the Hundred Years' War. Someone who is later captured by them and burned at the stake, but years later deemed innocent by the church and beatified. Today, Joan of Arc is the symbol of France's nationalism. This is where France's National Party gathers, and the leader of the party, Ms. Marine Le Pen, holds her gatherings and makes her speeches.
سخنرانی‌هاش هم اینجا انجام میده.
Extremist parties are now slowly coming to power everywhere in Europe, with young leaders, extreme nationalist slogans, and an insatiable appetite in strengthening national sovereignty. The slogans they chant are at times like the fascist ones vocalized during the first half of the 20th century. The growing interest of the people in these parties can be the beginning of a huge crisis for the EU. Politicians who don't like the European Union have now made it to European parliaments. But today, the policies of European governments and their fragile coalitions, which have been struck because of the emergence of the extreme right, are like these locks that those in love attach to these bridges as a memorabilia. These policies are locked, and for the time being, there are no solutions for them. Maybe after Britain, it might be the turn of other countries, for example, France.
A country like France has, Britain has, but Britain and France in the same European Union didn't work because they both have nuclear arms. They both sit on the United Nations Security Council as permanent members, and since they have different interests, different regions in the world, it was always hard for them to agree to the European Union to develop a common policy. But now, with Germany and France, it could be that the Germans will be willing to underwrite sort of some of the traditional French foreign policy concerns. One doesn't.
All these events have one important reason. Today, the challenges and crises European countries are dealing with differ from what they faced in the past. Europe has been completely rebuilt and is back at the peak of development. The Security Council and NATO have for years maintained peace in Europe. The USSR has collapsed, and a force from the East does not threaten Europe anymore. But the US, with the strange policies of its most unbalanced president in its history, and China, with its most devastating trade, have targeted Europe's not-so-resilient economy. Today, new dangers threaten Europe, and the bloc cannot do much in any of these instances. The same flames which are buried under the ashes of all this concrete and metal, economic crises, refugees, social gaps, anti-immigration sentiments, and extremism. Now the bloc is so overwhelmed by its internal problems that it does not even have the influence and credibility of the past. They cannot even stay fully committed to the implementation of a simple international treaty.
Britons, Great Britain, have destroyed Europe and got out of it. So very, very clever decision, because they have fled from the ship coming down. So I think that that was the reason of decline.
This is my assessment during my trips. The exit of Britain from the EU, the possible exit of some other important countries in the future, weaker European countries joining the bloc, new challenges which the bloc faces, and the people's leaning toward nationalist movements which oppose the EU, all have come together to create a not-so-bright future for this important international institute.
That is Brexit, and the other is affirmation of independence by Hungary, by Poland, and somehow by Greece. So Eastern Europe is in revolt against European.
The weakening of the strength of the European Union as one of the present era's big powerhouses makes its rivals happy. That's why Trump welcomes Brexit. Or, for example, it's for the same reason that Aaron Banks, one of the most ardent supporters of Brexit, has extensive trade relations with Russia. Competition with 28 small countries is easier than coming face to face with a big bloc. And it doesn't seem that China is too upset about the weakening of a troubled Europe either.
The Germans think that they are not Germans, they are Europeans. So everything that's good for Germany is by definition good for Europe. So they don't see, they don't think they are Germanizing Europe. What they think is they are Europeanizing Europe, because they turn it into a copy of Germany. The Americans were like that. Americans believed that everybody should be like Americans, and that was not Americanizing them, but it was humanizing the world. Yeah? And the Russians, basically, when they still had an empire, functioned in the same way, or the French. Yeah? So I think it's part of an imperial outlook that you think that it's good for other people to be like we are. Yeah. And it's natural for other people. You don't have to do much. You only have to give them a chance to wake up, and then they will immediately see, let's become Germans.
At least at the level of European politicians, the worries are not that deep. It doesn't seem that collapse, or at least the familiar way it happened in the East, is being expected for the European Union. It doesn't seem that we are witnessing the breakup of the bloc the way it happened to the League of Nations. Will the European Union remain intact? Will France remain in the EU?
They're not large enough to pose a serious threat to the European Union and to European integration. And certainly if the European Union is going to collapse, which I don't think is going to happen, it will be more due to internal struggles between different interests of different countries than of the role of the radical right.
So I think that the European Union as it stands today will not collapse, but it might transform, which we can see already with Brexit and phenomena related to that. And but I do not think that a Europe that is made out of independent national states.
Nearly 70 years after the Paris meeting, the Europeans only have two options. They either have to make the structure of the bloc compatible with today's world, or go back to the pre-war era, the era of dispersion, a Europe which is prone to the rise of the likes of Hitler, Franco, and Salazar, something that is not too far-fetched with the re-emergence of the extremist right.
The European Union is a unique political structure, and in order to understand it, you have to understand the individual member countries and their very complex relations with each other and with the center, and the power relations between the two most powerful states, France, Germany, who have a very complicated relationship between them. And then they also have interests with respect to the periphery, which sometimes overlap and sometimes they don't. So the complexity of this system is enormous, and that will continue. So in order to understand it, you have to really take a very hard and good look.
Will this joyous atmosphere continue? Should Europe expect more exits? How long will these stars remain in the blue sky of Europe? These are questions Europe has to answer. And an entire world is waiting for these answers.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection
of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. In Islam, women are asked to behave properly even before the mahram ones, like father or brother. This means that their manner and clothing must be proper and based on Islamic teachings. No woman is allowed in Islam to be naked or half naked in front of their grandparents, uncle, or other mahram members of the family. The personal and special relation between spouses is only limited to them, and no one is allowed to enter their realm. In simple words, hugging and kissing between spouses in front of non-mahrams is something haram and is considered a sin. No sound mind would disclose his or her personal relation to others to show that there is love between them. This will arouse the sexual powers of strangers and is in fact a door to satanic temptations. Thus, in Islam, wife and husband are asked to act chastely in front of others, even their mahram ones. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Private Indian refiners are jostling with independence in China for Russian ESPO crude loading in April, industry sources have said. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Reuters reported this week, citing industry sources, Chinese private refineries are jostling with their Indian counterparts for April volumes of seaborne Russian ESPO blend oil. After Western customers opted to shun direct purchases of Russian energy exports, China and India have become major buyers of Russian crude. China, which commonly purchases the entire volumes of the ESPO crude shipped from the Pacific port of Cosmino due to its close proximity, is expected to import record volumes in March. As for April, Indian independent refiners Reliance Industries and Nayara Energy have reportedly swept up at least 5 of the roughly 33 cargoes loaded with ESPO crude due to their low prices. That is up from only one vessel for March delivery, its first since buying 3 cargoes for November 2022. Sources familiar with the matter told Reuters prices for April loading ESPO crude to India were about $5 per barrel below Dubai, quotes on a delivered ex-ship DES basis. Reuters calculations also show that the rising demand has pushed prices for Russian low sulfur ESPO blend bought by Indian refiners above the $60 per barrel cap set by the G7 nations on the Russian seaborne crude. China has also been buying ESPO at above the price cap level. To reduce the risk exposure, importers of Russian oil are using currencies other than dollar to settle certain niche Russian crudes and are also asking the sellers to handle shipping and insurance. According to trading sources, competition from India has reduced discounts for April loading ESPO shipments to about $6.80 per barrel against the June ICE Brent DES basis to northern China from $8.50 a barrel last month for March loading oil. Morban crude of similar quality from Abu Dhabi was traded at a premium of around $3.30 a barrel to Dubai, quotes on a free on-board basis, while April loading Morban crude is about $9 a barrel more expensive than ESPO delivered to China and India. In March, Russian oil shipments to China are expected to reach an all-time high of nearly 43 million barrels, including at least 20 million barrels of ESPO. Meanwhile, Modern Diplomacy wrote U.S.-led international sanctions on Russia have begun to erode the dollar's decades-old dominance of international oil trade as most deals with India, Russia's top outlet for seaborne crude, have been settled in other currencies, informs Reuters. The dollar's predominance has periodically been called into question, and yet it has continued because of the overwhelming advantages of using the most widely accepted currency for business. India's oil trade in response to the turmoil of sanctions and the Ukraine crisis provides the strongest evidence so far of a shift into other currencies that could prove lasting. An Indian refining source said most Russian banks have faced sanctions since the crisis, but Indian customers and Russian suppliers are determined to keep trading Russian oil. The source told Reuters Russian suppliers will find some other banks for receiving payments. India's largest lender, State Bank of India, has a nostro or foreign currency account in Russia. Similarly, many banks from Russia have opened accounts with Indian banks to facilitate trade. IMF Deputy Managing Director Geeta Gopinath said that sanctions on Russia could erode the dollar's dominance by encouraging smaller trading blocs using other currencies. Paying for oil in dollars has been the nearly universal practice for decades. The dollar would remain the major global currency even in that landscape, but fragmentation at a smaller level is certainly quite possible, she told the Financial Times. Beyond Russia, tensions between China and the West are also eroding the long-established norms of dollar-dominated global trade. India, in the last year, displaced Europe as Russia's top customer for seaborne oil, snapping up cheap barrels and increasing imports of Russian crude 16-fold compared to before the crisis, according to the Paris-based International Energy Agency. Russian crude accounted for about a third of its total imports. For Indian refiners that in recent weeks started settling some Russian oil purchases in rubles, according to the trade sources, payments have been processed in part by the State Bank of India via its Nostro rubles account in Russia. India has prepared a framework for settling trade with Russia in Indian rupees should ruble transactions be cut off by further sanctions, the sources said. The group of seven economies, the European Union and Australia, agreed the price cap late last year to bar Western services and shipping from trading Russian oil unless sold at an enforced low price to deprive Moscow of funds for the crisis. It does not work as they want it.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayr din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We we're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. It's about a couple of episodes that we've started talking about the rules related to the travelers' prayers and fasting. And we'd like to continue along the same line with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question, because last time when you were speaking about, if I'm not mistaken, about the seventh condition, you talked about those people whose job is traveling. First of all, I want to ask you to delineate this concept and elaborate on it a little bit more for our dear audience. And what do you mean by someone whose job is traveling? And sometimes you see that some people's job requires traveling, like a driver, a chauffeur, a sailor, a shepherd, or even nomads when you talked about it, right?
Yeah.
Some people's jobs require some kind of preliminary acts of traveling.
Yes.
What do you mean by this? So does that include, this rule apply to all of his, for example, this guy's prayer or fasting?
Well, when it comes to traveling being someone's job, I think it seems to be it seems to be incorrect to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Probably we should paraphrase it in some way to make it more clear.
Mm-hmm.
A person does not travel for the sake of traveling.
Yes.
So it's not, it cannot be a job, it cannot be a profession whatsoever. Because everyone travels for a purpose. And in order to reach a point or go to a place to do some, let's say, job, okay? Whether you are, for example, a shepherd or, let's say, a driver, you are not driving for the sake of driving. You are carrying something. You are, let's say, going to a place in order to deliver something. So so it is actually, we have to say it, a job which involves traveling, and that could be a proper, paraphrase for the for what some of the scholars, like late Imam Khomeini, for example, he has said, one whose job is traveling. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So one whose job is traveling, you can put it in this way, that one who travels as a part of his job. His job requires him to travel. So. When it comes to the preliminary to someone's job, if you want to do a job, you need to travel. Like, for example, in modern time, the factories are outside the city. They remain to be, like, let's say, 20 kilometers, 30 kilometers, even 100 kilometers. People in metropolitan cities, they cannot work in the cities. They have to travel. They have to drive to those workplaces. And of course, these workplaces are located very far from the city. And of course, if a person is habitually going back and forth, he does not have to shorten his prayer, because this is a normal part of his life, and this is very routine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and someone who's traveling, let's say
traveling is his livelihood.
Yeah. He travels, like, say, once every 10 days, or even more than once, So he should, of course, offer complete prayers, and he should observe fast as well.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back, and don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. It's me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the rules related to the travelers' prayers and fasting with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, you talked about one of the conditions as to shorten the prayer. Because of that condition, if it happens, and that is about actually, residing in a place, in an area for a while. So if somebody, for example, has to stay somewhere like exceeding 1 year, or for example, a soldier, in order to complete his military service, he needs to stay there for around 2 years, for about 2 years, right? So is it obligatory for him to, intend to stay there for at least 10 days after each trip? So that they could perform the prayers, for example, in full, or fast during the month of Ramadan.
Or what rule applies to their prayers and fasting if they intend to stay for less than 10 days?
Yeah. There are a lot of such people who encounter such questions. We have students, we have there are soldiers, working with the army, and of course they stay, they are recruited soldiers. Now they just as you said, as you rightly mentioned, they stay in a city for 1 year or less. Okay, so according to His Eminence, even if they do not intend to stay and stay there, since they are going to practically stay in a city, because their plans and everything is clear, they decide to stay in a city for 1 year or more or less. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So according to His Eminence, in this given case that you just mentioned, they should offer full prayer and of course fast in that city.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, what about the pilots or flight attendants? What happens to their prayers and fasting? Because they're constantly on their fly, from one base to another, from one airport to another, all right? They travel a large distance.
Yes, of course.
And some of them, they may be back quickly, by the way, all right?
Yeah.
So what happens to their Sharia distance?
You're right. Well, they should follow the rules that are applicable to drivers, to sellers, to those people who frequently travel,
mm-hmm.
and who go back and forth. They travel from one airbase to another airbase, to one airport to another airport. And these are people who are literally called professional travelers. Yes. Again, I'm using the word professional travelers. Traveling is not a profession, but they, as part of their job, they should travel.
Mm-hmm.
A pilot is someone who cannot, who must travel. And, of course, these are people who should, follow the rules which are applied to car drivers, to, sellers, and so on and so forth. So, therefore, their rule in this regard is the rule of car drivers or sellers or
chauffeurs.
And these are people during their traveling, and they have to pray full, and their fasting is also valid.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We try to talk about some of the questions and answers related to travelers' prayers and fasting. But, of course, there are lots of other questions that are remaining, and we'd like to postpone them to the upcoming episode. So stay with us. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun malajabilaha illahum ghaffarun. لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.